welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the club's Arts Forum and your organizer for today. We're delighted to bring you a wonderful panel of artists for a discussion of what is the arts mainstream. The panel is a program for the member-led forum's August platform, which is where groups, all the various forums, do a program around the same theme. This year, the theme is the LGBT journey. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator, Brad Erickson, who will introduce the other artists. Lenore Chin, artist, whose work is part of the exhibition LGBTQ Art, Our Commonwealth, you see around you here in the Gold Room and in the hallways outside. New Conservatory Theater and artistic director and founder, Ed Decker, and poet, playwright, Jewel Gomez. Brad Erickson is the executive director of Theater Bay Area and chair of California Arts Advocates. He's also an accomplished playwright who has recently completed a Jurassic Foundation residency. Maybe he'll tell us a little bit more about those experiences in the progress of the panel. Brad, over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Anne, and thank you, everyone, for being here today. I was really delighted when Anne started talking to me about this topic several months ago. It's really a fascinating one, and I'm really delighted to have this group of panelists with me today. All of us have been making art for a while, and we've seen a number of artists. I think we've seen the world change a good deal over the last three, four decades or more. I remember when I came to San Francisco in the mid-80s from Chicago, young man kind of finding my way and finding my orientation and finding a sense of who I was. The places where I hooked into at the time and could find out about sort of my community and who I was and where sort of people who had gone before as well, there were just a couple of them. One that came to mind and that I got plugged into pretty quickly was Theater Rhinoceros, which is actually how I know Ed. He directed me in a show there a number of years ago. and this was a place where we could see gay and lesbian stories, and they were stories that I had never really seen before. There were maybe one play that I remember reading when I was in drama school at the time. Bent had been come out, and that was eye-opening to me. I hadn't seen anything like it. Then I learned about Boys in the Band a little later, but that was really it. And so the plays that were being done at Theater Rhinoceros, this is before Ed founded New Conservatory and its Pride season, were the first time for me to hear many of those stories and certainly to see them on stage. And another place in town for me was a Different Lights bookstore on Castro Street, which is where you could find novels and poetry and journals and literature about the gay experience, which again for me was completely eye-opening, and I couldn't find it anywhere else. And of course, this is long before the internet or anything like that, and certainly way before anything like Will and Grace and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Ellen DeGeneres and all of the things that we've seen happen over the course of the last 30 or 40 years. I would imagine that the experience of growing up as a gay young person today is extremely different than it was for me, and maybe for Ed and Lenore and Jewel as well. And so I think it's a fascinating topic today to look into how LGBT themes and artists and art itself has been embraced by much of the mainstream, what we see on TV, what we see in films, what we read and hear. And we'll look into some of that, and then we'll also look into sort of what are today's challenges, what isn't being addressed perhaps in the mainstream, and a topic I think that will be important for these artists here is what is the role of the gay or LGBTQ-oriented arts organization and its role today maybe versus the role that it had in the 1980s. So that's a little bit of an outline, I think, of what we'll be talking about. I want to ask each of the panelists to just tell us a little bit about themselves and their work before we dive into the topic. So I'll start on my immediate left with Jewel Gomez.
Hi, everyone. My genres, I guess, are playwriting and fiction. I've written a black lesbian vampire novel that's been in print for 25 years. And they told me no one would buy it. And they were wrong. And I've recently, in the last several years, been writing plays. I also am a poet. And do some cultural criticism.
Great, thank you. And Ed?
As you know, now that I'm the founding artistic director at New Conservatory Theater Center here in San Francisco, and that adventure began 33 years ago with my desire to create a progressive arts education program for young people to be able to explore their stories and come to some understanding of who they are. And that evolved into our Pride season, which is now in its 20th year, producing queer and allied works year-round for all audiences of all ages.
Eleanor.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for organizing this wonderful event. I am a San Francisco native. There aren't that many of us left in the city. And I am primarily a painter. That's my primary expressive medium. But I also do some photography. My work has been primarily portrait-based, and I've been doing a lot of this for ever since I was little. But in terms of our LGBT queer community, a lot of that began in the early 80s. At a time when people thought I was quite out of my mind to be doing this kind of work, and why would I do this? Why don't I do universal themes? Wouldn't I be selling more if I was doing something else? We'll get into this more, but that's one of the reasons why I held on to a day job in healthcare until I retired a few years ago, because it allowed me to do the kind of art and political forays that I was doing back in the day. Thank you.
Great, and I should point out that some of Lenore's work is actually right here in the room with us, so the painting on the back wall and also the painting on right above the bureau as you came in are two of Lenore's paintings.
Mm. So beautiful.
There's the work in the room. It is beautiful.
Thank you.
So let me just throw that out there. I mean, in terms of, it really has been, it seems like, a remarkable change over the course of the last 30 years in terms of the way that LGBT artists and themes and art have been accepted into the mainstream and taken off by the mainstream. And I just wonder, I don't know, I'll start with you, Ed. Maybe talk a little bit about what you've seen with plays, maybe what's happening in theater with those things.
Well, as you said, when we first met back in the 80s, I was also a younger artist and found community at Theater Rhinoceros with the then founders Alan Estes and Chuck Solomon. And during those times, it was that the stories were about sort of getting out the fact that we're here, everyone, and we needed to first share our stories within our community. I think that was the starting point for the storytelling that we were doing in the, you know, in the theater. And in the 80s, we started to see some major playwrights take on work that highlighted the lives of the LGBT community. And of course, you know, things are very different today. I don't know if you want to sort of talk about now or later, but it felt to me that in the 80s it was really about sort of we're here and sort of coming together as the community. And then as we moved into the early 90s, we also had to deal with the HIV, AIDS crisis, which really I think, spun the work that we were doing in a very necessary direction, because we were losing our lives and we had to use the arts as a platform for articulating our needs. So it was more than just we're here. We also had to add we're here and we're fighting for our lives in even more profound ways than we were before, when there was sort of just hiding in the closet, which was certainly difficult enough for many as we in America. So things really, I think, changed in the 90s as we pushed through and told our stories, and in many ways forced our government to take action that they were dragging their feet against. And I think that without the queer community sort of leading that charge on all fronts, artistic and political and otherwise, I don't think we would have seen the progress that we saw in the face of that great bit of adversity there. And then I think moving out of that, and at least in the theatrical contest, and moving into the next decade, we began to sort of touch the mainstream. And it's so interesting to be here talking about this today, because back then it was like, I don't think, I couldn't imagine really ever talking about this as a mainstream, issue. And so now it feels that the conversation is about inclusivity and understanding the queer community in a much broader context, and that we are a part of sort of every fabric of society, and we're woven together in some really essential, organic, holistic ways. So that's quite a journey for storytelling to have accomplished in really a relatively short period of time. I'm looking at about a 30-year, period of time.
Yeah. Jewel, nope. your view on this?
Well, I think of the mainstream, I actually refer to it as the meanstream. And I love to quote Grace Paley on this. The mainstream is broad and shallow, and all the action is in the tributaries. And I feel like I've had the gift of being in several of the tributaries where action and energy has been focused because of the political circumstances. And to return to Bent, because that was one of the first things that came to my mind when I received the questions about what were benchmarks for you. And certainly Bent, Martin Sherman's Bent, which I went to see on Broadway in 1980 with Richard Gere and David Duke, and they practically had to call an ambulance to carry me home. Mm-hmm. I was so devastated and moved. And for me, the themes that are in that piece, and the kind of connectivity that Martin Sherman created, are for me at the core of what makes queer art really work. He used queer characters to see what it means to be human and what it means to be inhuman, what it means to love or to be unable to love, and what it takes to be part of the world or to retreat into unseeing fantasy. And I think most art wants to do that, and queer art at its best does that. And so the question for me is, when will the mainstream evolve enough to be ready to accept queer characters or people of color characters as well, delivering those messages? And I think it's really about how the mainstream, and I think of producers and audiences, how they can evolve to see us, because I think we often remain invisible to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lenore, you were mentioning just at the outset about sort of your experience as an artist working and sort of feeling like, well, you were rejecting perhaps a more lucrative career to be able to continue to work touch the themes that you wanted to touch. Maybe speak a little bit about that, and has the world changed in the last 30 years?
Yes and no. Some of what Ed was saying kind of triggered some memories of one of the early group shows. I think it was in the early 80s, because I think this sort of predated the onset of what we would come to know as HIV/AIDS. And that is when local artists, who thankfully is still around, Frank Pietronegro, organized an outdoor exhibit called Art in the Park in the Banshaw Concourse. And it was held around the time that the Gay Games was going on as well. A lot of the work that I would see in that time frame was largely almost like storefront, organized by various artists on a grassroots level. I think some of the images that one might, you know, find more common now in circulation was probably more confined to private studio showings and that kind of thing, particularly south of Market, the leather scene and all of that. But what I also thought about is as we move through the mid to late 80s, along with projects that Frank and other gay men that I knew were doing, there was also some grassroots organizing by people like L.A. Happy Hider, who had been part of a Dynamics of Color conference, I believe, that was held at the Women's Building. And she's a local photographer, and eventually she began to talk about the idea of forming an organization that would identify lesbians in the visual arts, and I was part of that in its early day. And we had newsletters and tried to identify particularly people of color who were the least visible, because there are hierarchies. And so by coming together in that way, in that strategy, it's like any other political movement. You try to find who your people are. And out of that grew sort of a network. And this was before the internet, you know. I think now, I wouldn't say it's easy, but certainly easier to communicate and to identify people. I was at the LGBT History Museum the other day, and it was a gathering of a group of young Asians. It was called the Dragon Fruit Project, and I went there, and I thought, my God, I'm old enough to be their grandparent, you know. But it was inspiring, because you could see what this generation is doing. How they're organizing, how they're able to mobilize. What I would like to see, and this is still, I think, an issue in terms of museums that are history-oriented, is that it needs to more and more embrace the arts as part of our history.
Yeah. Lenore, both you and Jewel have touched on this a bit, and it might be good for us to kind of loop back on it, but certainly, particularly in the 70s and 80s, but continuing into today, there has been a sense that sort of gay culture, anyway, in the LGBT kind of Q world, has been rather dominated by middle-class white men. And as two women of color, I wonder about where you feel that, if those stories have become more mainstream, and they have been, perhaps, have the stories and the artists and the themes coming from other parts of the LGBTQ world, particularly women and people of color, how is that happening? Is that being mainstreamed? And maybe that's a good thing that it's not. I don't know. I just wonder where you think that's landing.
Who wants to start with that one?
Well, I do think, maybe this is part of a long series.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Every Friday.
Yeah.
Right, every Friday for the rest of our lives. Certainly, we can't have this discussion without
acknowledging and maybe not having the time to get into the differences between how white gay men are perceived and received, mm-hmm. and how lesbians are perceived and received, and how people of color are perceived and received. They're vastly different, certainly in the larger general culture, as well as among queer people. So for lesbians, our cultural development, and I'm speaking very generally, was supported by a feminist movement. The women's press movement of the 70s provided a forum for lesbians to create. My first writing was as part of a collective that published a magazine, Conditions Magazine, and other Sinister Wisdom magazine, other magazines that were devoted to lesbians' work. So I had a whole community looking to give voice to lesbians' ideas and issues. And I think for different reasons, that was where I was able to make my breakthroughs. I don't think that translated into any kind of mainstream recognition or success, certainly for me. It did, I think, for some other authors, but when it did, it usually was authors who weren't necessarily writing about being a lesbian. You know, you think about fabulous writers like Dorothy Allison, who's also on the Conditions Collective with me. Her first novel, Bastard Out of Carolina, is a major literary work, but it's really not about being a lesbian. So where a lesbian is in the mainstream remains kind of shadowy. You know, if you look at the plays on mainstream stages, you look at the books in mainstream bookstores, you're not seeing a lot of lesbian literature. You're not seeing a lot of lesbian drama. And with the loss of independent and women's bookstores, literature by lesbians has had to regroup and figure out how to support each other. And I don't feel lesbian drama and in the theater is going to grow in any kind of mainstream context, because nobody believes that anyone is interested in women, much less in lesbians. That's the first thing. That is the first thing a producer will talk about. What's the audience is going to pull? When I first tried to get the Gilda stories published 25 years ago, I literally had an editor say to me, "Well, it's black, it's lesbian, she's a vampire, that's too complicated." I'm thinking, I'm not trying to sell this to a 2-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know, what does that mean, it's too complicated? If you layer on ethnicity, mm-hmm. and sexuality, and if the sexuality is not heterosexual, it's automatically too complicated.
Yeah.
So it's about where you're locating the power, and mainstream is not really interested in moving the power from one area, expanding it to another. Do I sound bitter? She said laughing.
Lenore, let me get your take on this.
Well, again, these comments trigger other little things, so I go off on tangents. Mm-hmm. But what struck me also is the economics is always involved in there. And I was thinking of a couple of films that dealt with lesbian topics. But they were lesbian topics woven within another story, and that's also the complexity that we face getting this kind of work out there. Two films come to mind, Saving Face, which I saw at the Embarcadero Center some years ago, and the other one was Fire. And that one was shown at both the Asian Film Festival and at Frameline. Now, I think I saw it originally at the Asian Film Festival, and then I decided I'll go see it again because it was coming to the Castro. It was in my neighborhood. Well, there were a number of people who were in the line who already had tickets, like myself, and then there was this huge line of people waiting to get in because they had just found out about it, and they wondered, well, how come there's so many people already with tickets? Well, some of us had already heard of it because it was at the previous film festival. But the problem a lot of these filmmakers and artists face is that if they don't do well in the first weekend, if they are able to get a mainstream venue to show, then it just dies in the water. You know, sometimes if it's a very interesting or informative documentary that comes out during a film festival, then it might get some kind of an audience through PBS or something like that. With visual arts, I think it's even more difficult, you know. And I know that certainly when I was studying art history back in the day, there weren't any women even in the Bible of the day, History of Art by Janssen. You know, not even Georgia O'Keeffe or Mary Cassatt, two white women. Years go by, decades go by, and we're still trying to trace who we are, you know, and unless you've read something like what Harmony Hammond put together some years ago, Lesbian Art in America, Contemporary Art History, or reference other resources, then none of these names would be household names. None of them. And that's also true for artists of color, even who are not lesbian. A friend of mine was saying that she encountered a woman who had never heard of Ruth Asawa. And she was shocked. This is before she died, you know. But she faced those same issues as well. And she also faced the opinion that her work was not art. You know, it was craft. You know. So those are other layers that we face.
Right. And I was at an event at New Conservatory several months ago, and it was you were kind of rolling out your new season to your supporters and subscribers, and I was so impressed with you. You brought out some of the youth that are in the program there, and every single one of these high school kids was a person of color. And I thought, you know, we have this sort of student narrative that we tell ourselves about LGBT often being, as I had just mentioned, you know, something for, you know, middle class to affluent white men. And I was so impressed with that group of kids that you're working with, and I'm just wondering how are you seeing, you know, gay and lesbian youth today, and this particularly youth of color, responding to their own sexuality and coming out in their communities and the ways that you're working with them.
Great question, Brad. Well, first of all, being in the San Francisco Bay Area and the San Francisco Unified School District, the sort of the rainbow of ethnicity is the community in which we, you know, the community that we are a part of. So that connection is a very natural one for us. We just completed last week a pilot program that has been funded by an organization called the Mukti Fund, which is our Youth Out and United program. And what that program, this is the second year of the pilot, and that program was designed to create a space specifically for queer and allied youth to engage in conversation through the theater and create a devised piece based on their vision of the world that lies ahead of them and how they want to see it, but also rooted in the experiences that they're having in their lives right now. Mm-hmm. And again, the program is a scholarship-based program, so we took the financial piece out of the equation so that young people could simply participate and not have that constraint as a condition of their participation. So what we're seeing in the generation that's coming up is an extreme willingness, and I saw this 30 years ago as well, as young people were always ready to take on the the world and we're invincible and we have this amazing courage and ability to just sort of plunge ahead and make things happen. And that is still true today, but added into the component now is this sense of connectedness that is starting to emerge for young people. The first thing that is different in that connectedness is that young people have seen that, are beginning to see that sexual identity and sexual orientation belong to all humanity, and that it's a very fluid dynamic, and it has to do with feelings and emotion and so forth, and not being frightened of those feelings and emotions is a step that teenagers in particular are beginning to incorporate into their lives. So when you take that piece of it out, then they start to sort of position that same question of sexual identity against the rest of the society around them and start to push back or push forward with their value system and their understanding and their belief system. And I think this is how change happens, because they are first incorporating it within, finding the power within, understanding it, and then moving it outward amongst first their smaller community, and then as they continue to develop and grow, they become part of the mainstream and are sort of pushing the barriers, you know, in that particular context. So I see a lot of extraordinary force and movement in the generation that is coming ahead.
It's interesting. And, you know, I think so many of us have seen surveys that are taken, and we're seeing that young people have, you know, very tolerant views around difference of all kinds, but particularly around things like same-sex marriage and rights that should or should not be given to gay people. Given those changes in attitudes, I'm just wondering, Lenore and Jewel, about this question of, like, what else needs to be done? And Ed, well, you two can, I mean, let's all talk about that. If the new generation has kind of very different attitudes than its parents did, and if the world is changing to some degree, what needs to be done still? Because I think there is a good deal to be done. Lenore, maybe you could jump in.
Well, actually, it brings to mind my own relationship with my relatives, and I have a lot of relatives. My dad was one of 12 children, so we have very large reunions. And I have other gay relatives in my family. And I have a nephew who grew up with two gay aunties, one on each side of his family. And as far as he's concerned, I think that was his normal. And years go by, and as a young adult, he would periodically ask, well, you know, is so-and-so in the family going to get married? And at that time, I'm sure he didn't think about it, you know. But now my cousin has married his partner, and he probably won't be the last, you know. And I think with today's young people, they're redefining their own personal landscape and how they move in the world. The vernacular has changed quite a bit. Sometimes I find it hard to keep up. But I think what we need to do is make sure that we keep encouraging those young people and that we pass the stories on to them and that we keep the line open, because they have views that we need to hear as well, you know. So I think that can only help, and it's a healthy way to keep our community growing.
And just echoing that, you know, redefining that vernacular is exactly what we were doing as young people as well. So that cycle just continues to move and grow.
Right. I feel really, really pleased to have worked with Ed at New Conservatory, because I feel like he carries the answer to the question. Institutions. I can't tell you the number of times I've been hanging out with my friends, baby boomers, and we always are saying, what happened to feminism? It's like the young women, they don't remember it, they don't know what it means, it hasn't changed their perspective that much. And I said, well, no one is teaching it to them. Women's studies classes are not about social change, they're about people getting tenure. So how do we pass on the lessons learned around social change? And it's only if we have our own institutions. When I did was working, developing my play about James Baldwin, Waiting for Giovanni, in the readings I did outside of San Francisco before it was produced here, I can't tell you the level of history lesson I had to give to the actors who didn't know who James Baldwin really was, who didn't know who Lorraine Hansberry was, or if they knew, they didn't really realize he was gay. I mean, it was a nightmare. It was like these children had been plucked out of some pods in a field. And I was happy to do it, and it was great, and we had great fun. They didn't know who some of the other peripheral characters were, Richard Wright. I mean, it was bizarre. And it's because nobody was teaching it. And institutions, the creations of our own institutions, I think is really the only way that next generations actually get a handle on it. And New Conservatory, working with young people within a queer context, within a progressive context, because it's about queerness and how it relates to larger world and other oppressions. And unless we create our own institutions that are lasting, that have spaces, that have ongoing and diverse programs, we face remaking the world every day.
Right. Thank you, because it's such a great segue. And maybe let's explore this question a little bit more with, you know, maybe utilizing New Conservatory as an example, the LGBTQ center that we have here in the city. That role of the institution, I think it was very different, as you were mentioning, Ed, in the 80s when Theater Rhinoceros was here, and it was like the only arts institution that was, you know, for gays and lesbians, and it was one of the few in the whole country. What it's like now, and that continuing role of the institution in supporting the art and supporting artists and moving topics forward.
Well, I think the network is growing. I mean, we're very blessed in the Bay Area to have a strong group of folks that are running museums and Rhino and New Conservatory and the LGBT Center and the Hormel Center at the library and the work that's going on in the public schools. There's a lot of extraordinary things that are going on. And I think that moving the needle forward is also about sort of getting out of our bubble here in the San Francisco Bay Area, and also recognizing that, you know, there's a lot of power to be built and found. Recently, New Conservatory Theater Center updated its mission statement to name the queer and allied communities, along with the youth communities that we serve, all under one very concise, articulated umbrella, because we found that we wanted to move the conversation to name all of those things, but also looking ahead at partnership with the allies, not just that are within our San Francisco community, but sort of pushing that out, which is why we established the Pride on Tour program, which goes into rural areas and helps, takes the show from our season and helps, spends a year in the communities building towards a performance of that show, but for the reason of creating a catalyst for a conversation that is more than about buying a ticket and coming to see a play, but it's about what's going on in your community and how do we build strength within our community, but also open that, you know, flower up and see and introduce ourselves to our allies and build those relationships. And when you sort of look at things nationally and internationally, because of the power of the web, I think, we're seeing that those kinds of broader connections, the reach is getting further, the arms that are embracing us are getting bigger, and we're seeing a lot of change, I think, come from the power of building partnerships and relationships with allies. Not that we should stop standing up to our foes, But, you know, I discovered a while ago at New Conservatory that I was probably not going to change the fundamentalist's mind with my with my San Francisco production of Terrence McNally's Gay Jesus play Corpus Christi. I just thought, they're not going to come. And so when I realized that you know, I love standing up to those situations and think we always should through our work, but I also realized that there's great advantage to building power with your allies and mm-hmm. moving people to newer understandings that you know, connect to them a bit more of a everyday living, you know, way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Lenore, tell us a little bit about where you see the LGBT Center and its work as an institution as well.
Well, the LGBT Center, they have had a number of exhibitions in there, but what I wanted to also talk about is QCC, the Queer Cultural Center, sure. which is often confused for the physical space on Market Street. The LGBT Center over on Market does host a number of programs, but it's actually QCC that creates the opportunity to have artists, performance, film, visual arts, and whatnot. They do this primarily through the National Queer Arts Festival in June, but they also partner with a number of organizations throughout the year in the city to put things like this, for instance, at the Commonwealth Club. Part of what they had done and what we had done as founding members in the beginning is something that Ed had talked about, is that we reached across neighborhoods. Now, we couldn't get into our work into museums, per se, to save anybody's life at the time, and it's still tough. But by creating parallel institutions and opportunities for artists to express their authentic voices through programs at, say, Galleria de la Raza, or African American Art and Culture Center, or perhaps others might use MOAD as an opportunity to create some kind of programming. In that way, we build bridges. And so while we may not be able to get into what we might regard as the dominant culture-oriented museums and whatnot, I think a lot of us kind of look at a multi-pronged approach. You know, we have a number of friends of ours in the academic world, and where they're able to have, you know, a forum for a discussion of visual and critical studies in the arts and that kind of thing. They have that. Harmony Hammond is going to be doing something on Halloween night, actually, at Timken Hall at CCA. We try to kind of spread things out so that we don't close ourselves off from an opportunity, you know, where it might present ourselves. I mean, years ago, some of us kind of started off at various street festivals because that's the only way we can get anything out. Or we would have our work in various lesbian gay rags, for instance, and that's actually how T. Corinne found my work, because, you know, she was a collector of archival material, and she was very good at that. She found people all over the country, and then she would encourage some of us to fly out to New York or wherever there was a conference. The College Art Association and has an annual conference, so if you want to go out in the dead of winter when it's cheaper, and that's when they have those events, then you could insert your views into the quote-unquote mainstream discourse. Because in its early day, a lot of those conferences were very limited to the scholars. And when I started attending some of those, I thought, oh, gee, you know, some of us are still alive and we're producing work. Where's the artist's voice? You know, and so somewhere around the late 80s, early 90s, kind of referencing the time that Ed was referring to, I think the social political movement sort of helped to incubate those opportunities. And so by appearing in these academic settings, those topics could be discussed in a serious manner, you know? So I think that has helped sort of open up some doors.
Mm-hmm. I'm gonna move us to some of the questions that are coming. Hello, Anne, yes?
Hi. We do have a few questions, so
yeah.
Let us begin.
Yeah, we gay marriage is being used as an example of social movement in the right direction. Is this pink washing in the mainstream?
Pink washing?
I'm not sure how I understand that one.
I think the question is asking, is it kind of creating this rosy view of what gay rights is, perhaps, rather than the hard questions that gay rights poses? I think that's what the question is.
Go ahead, take that.
So
I
was actually a litigant in the first lawsuit against the state of California for the right to marry. And I actually don't believe in marriage as a feminist. I feel like it's a patriarchal institution and should be completely dismantled and rearranged. That said, my feeling has always been any movement for social change requires more than one approach. You need someone with the hammer. You need someone with the ability to have dialogue. You need all of the different elements in order to make any kind of social change. So I felt like the institution itself is very questionable, but it's got more people in the world talking about queer rights than anything that's gone before, except for HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And as I have said in the past, you know, the civil rights movement, of which I was a part of, you know, and people risked their lives to go to the South to sit in at Woolworth's, it wasn't because the food was good. It was so people could have the right to go or not go. And I feel that that's true. Now, of course, it gives you that impression that everybody should have a couple. And I think it's up to us to not let that become the dominant image of who queer people are.
Better, Lenore, want to weigh in on that? I mean, I do remember in the 90s, there was a great, great debate in the LGBT world about sort of whether or not queer people should be emulating marriage or not. And then that seemed to kind of just get completely drowned out by exactly what you're saying, the right to do it. But we never, like, picked up the debate.
The political discussion never really has followed.
Right.
And we were already emulating them. We were already having ceremonies on the beach and commitment things. We were already emulating them. So.
I agree. I think that the global awareness has increased in large part due to the discussion of marriage equality. And many folks are, thankfully, building the bridge from there to other very important international human rights issues around equality and safety and dignity and respect and non-violence in a variety of locations around the globe. And that's a particular passion of mine. I have to admit that I was very frustrated with the marriage equality debate at the very beginning of it, because I felt that it was a very eye-centered, Western-focused dynamic that we were discussing. And in the meantime, there were LGBT queer people all over the world that were being persecuted and killed and facing atrocious situations. I've come to the better understanding that the marriage equality conversation is actually facilitating a broader lens and shining a light onto these horrific things that are happening around the globe. And hopefully we'll be able to sort of use that bridge to advance human rights on an international scale.
I mean, it led us directly to the ideas around immigration reform.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So the participation of queer people in immigration reform movements has increased exponentially.
And then in that regard, you have fabulous local playwrights like Brad Erickson that just
tackle
that subject.
Yes, we do.
And give us beautiful plays like American Dream.
Put on my fearless producers. One of them at the table here. Well, here's one. My son is a poet and fiction writer who performs slam poetry. Any words of wisdom for young gay artists at UC Santa Cruz? Hi there.
Curiosity is one of the most exciting.
Curiosity
is part of a larger group of slam poets here in San Francisco, a group started by James Cass, and it has an energy around the politics that young people are facing, both gay and straight. It has venues for people to participate and to interact with each other around their work. So I would say connecting, getting him to come, you know, up here and connect with groups like that, or to think about, if he feels isolated, to think about how, as a writer, he could create his own small group. It only takes like two or three people, and suddenly you have a group, particularly around poetry, because poetry, I love it, it's so compact. You know, if you have three people and you invite 10 people to your room, your dorm room, and say, I'm giving free pizza, you got a poetry slam.
Right.
And you've got theater. It can
and you got theater.
This is a great question, and any one of you jump in on this. Are there programs that help explain, arts programs, that help explain gay life to non-gay queer people, to non-gay or queer people? So that what I'm reading into this is sort of like works of art, theater or other kinds of works of art, visual art, literature, that whose maybe the purpose of it is to act as a kind of bridge between one world and the next. Some might see that as being mainstreaming,
all.
But perhaps.
But I think that that is
all
queer art, I think of it, at its best, can act as a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Some art is so insular that only if you knew the novelist or the playwright would you understand it. But I think most art at its best is meant to be that kind of opening up of a world, I think.
I would agree with that, and I think that in the work with young people, and I perhaps just the community at large, you know, it's often quite illuminating for folks to realize that as far as the LGBT or the queer question is concerned, you know, that has been a part of societies throughout the ages and cultures throughout the ages. I mean, you can go back to almost any culture around the world and look at the storytelling that was happening there and find the sort of queer or the LGBT influence present. And so when we look at art, or when we give voice to art through our paintings and our words and our theater presentation, we're just continuing a very, very long tradition and highlighting the presence that has really always been there. And we, as a socially, we tend to just sort of forget about that because we get distracted by the things that are happening in present day, and our lives are complicated, and we have this responsibility to attend to. But when we just pause and step back and take a look at within any mainstream museum, you can see it. It's there.
So sometimes, though, I think audiences that are unfamiliar with that probably could benefit by people who are able to give a queer reading, because if you go into a mainstream museum, you may not know that David Hockney or any number of other artists come from a gay experience, or Andy Warhol. Well, maybe most people know Andy Warhol, you know what I mean. But there are people who... Did I just out him? you know, I think it helps. We're lucky, a friend of mine, friends of mine in Tucson, sent me an email recently because I had been passing information along about today's event and others. And they said, oh, you're so lucky out there that you're blessed to have, you know, a variety. And they had said that we were, unfortunately, we couldn't even keep our LGBT center open. You know, and so there are areas of the country that still face that kind of situation. We face it, too, here with gentrification at times. But because it is the Bay Area and because of the evolution of our, you know, the politics and the social framework that we have managed to put together over the years, we have something here that we can create a dialogue and an opportunity for networking and that kind of a thing. And so we can kind of create our sort of native informants for a variety of different places that we can send people and say, well, so-and-so, if you look at this, you can see the iconography that speaks to our queer experience.
And of course, it's always startling to realize that you don't have to go more than half hour to an hour outside of San Francisco to realize that some of those resources that you were mentioning, like mm-hmm. gay centers and programs like that, are struggling mm-hmm. to stay afoot because they don't have the critical mass in the organization
right.
to sort of advance.
Mm-hmm.
We need someone to give the Queer Cultural Center a building so that you could spend time creating art, showing art, and teaching about
mm-hmm.
art to all kinds of people who would come there to learn what's going on in the past and the future.
Excellent.
One more question?
Well, here's a quickly.
Or concluding thoughts.
Well, this is a real quick one. Just they're looking for examples of gay themes that you all have seen maybe recently at some of our larger institutions or maybe on the sort of media as well. So they're saying, what have you seen at SFLA, at the Opera, Berkeley Rep, ACT, Theater Works, Magic, or why don't we head into media as well? Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up something. I recently took a Whirlwind Museum trip to Southern California, and while I was down in the Palm Springs area, a friend of mine is a curator down there. He used to be up here in San Francisco, and one of the things that he told me and my friend Elizabeth Cornu, who used to be with Fine Arts Museums, to do is visit the Hammer Museum in L.A. They have an exhibit there called Made in L.A. 2014, and he said, you have to go there because there's a gay component. And the hilarious thing about it is there's a section where I think the guy's name is Tony Green. He's no longer around, but they had some of his work there. And there was a display case of gay ephemera that many of you might recognize as coming from old gay-oriented magazines that back in the day would never even be considered. And so our friend was saying, who knew that some of the stuff that I threw out would become museum material someday? You know? So it was very interesting.
And you know, just to add to that, since
yep.
the topic here is sort of mainstreaming,
yep.
I think some really exciting news is that across institutions, large, medium, and small, you're seeing the content of the queer community begin to move more fluidly across all of those platforms. And I think that's a real big difference from 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that gay themes are human themes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's who is able to use gay characters, as Martin Sherman did in Bend, to carry our story forward that does connect to the larger world. I think Tony Kushner's not the only person doing it, but
mm-hmm.
he's the person who pops into my head right away since I saw his play. And it was about the family. It was really a family drama. That had gay characters. And I think a lot of people are doing that. You know, I watch Vicious just so I can get to see two of the best actors in English theater act.
Rip it up. Yeah, they're chewing that scenery.
They're chewing up. But, you know, I want to see them. So I don't think that's the best example of gay life or gay themes. But, hey, Ian McKellen, I'll turn it on.
What a great way to wrap up this conversation. We could probably go on all afternoon or come back every Friday, but we will wrap up.
Thank you so much to our wonderful panel, Brad, Eric, Thank you so much for your work.